Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, alongside my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
Hello and welcome. No, so here's the thing. I always sit across from you and I always wonder if there's anybody who actually downloads and listens to the podcast like the minute it comes out, which is, what, 3 a.m. on the East Coast, midnight on the West Coast.
Yes.
Like, that would be quite the wake-up call.
Oh, yeah.
They could just set your voice as their alarm.
Oh, yeah. Just as soon as it comes in and you set your alarm, you set it to the opening of the podcast. And,
yeah.
Hello! I should start probably saying good morning, too, as well, maybe. I don't know.
What a great way to wake up. I mean, you hear that exuberant hello, and then we just drone on and on and on and on and on.
It's true.
About cool things.
Yes, we are back, ladies and gentlemen. We had an incredible week last week at San Diego Comic-Con. We went to Comic-Con,
woo-hoo,
my brother.
Yeah, we did.
Alongside with the VGB crew, we here at the Filmlosophers had an intense and incredible time out there, having many interviews, many conversations with a ton of people, seeing a ton of cosplay. And so we're going to go over that in a little bit. But before we do, the Filmlosophers is presented without any memory of its past by Mingle Media TV and recorded live at VGB Studios. Remember, you can subscribe to the Filmlosophers podcast on your favorite platform and download previous episodes from Google Play, iTunes, Player FM, Libsyn, Audio Boom, and Stitcher. If one touch point per week isn't enough for you, remember that you can like and follow the show on Facebook and Twitter at facebook.com/filmlosophers and twitter.com/filmlosophy101 and share your thoughts about recent movie news or our latest review episode. Also, I don't want to forget our new website, VGB Studios. It is up, it is kicking, it is live. If you want to catch our podcast along with Corey, hit me with the Mike's podcast.
Me, Mike, self, and I.
Yeah,
me,
Mike, self, and I. We kind of did not throw the right kind of love at our new podcast.
You got to think of the De La Soul song.
Me, Mike, self, and I.
Good Burger. You know, me, myself, and I.
Me, Mike, self, and I. Got it. You can catch...
I'm telling you, this is going to be a mental block on the level of, like, Andy Garcia versus Al Pacino for me. They're the same person. I don't know how to differentiate them, and it's my fault, and I know it.
So you can catch all our latest episodes, along with Mike's episodes, and the Video Game Bang podcast, as well, all on the same platform on the website at vgbstudios.com. Before we get into our review that we have for today, we're going to go over a couple of recaps that we have from this past week. As we said, we are coming straight from San Diego, experiencing the mecca of all nerddom, which is Comic-Con. Going over this past week, one of the biggest things that we honestly hit, probably literally, was the fact that it was so hot.
I was going to say, you got to say a wall of humidity.
I mean, so you walk outside your hotel.
I mean, more than the heat. I think the humidity because of the... And people on the East Coast throughout the middle of the country in the South, they all are like, don't talk about this. You don't know what you're talking about because it's still worse over here. But...
Which heat, I'm from, mind
heat
you.
Heat plus humidity is so much worse than heat by itself.
So as I said, the Filmlosophers as well as the Video Game Bang crew all had a chance to explore and experience Comic-Con this past week. And so we got Corey, the fly on the wall, to come on and actually talk a little bit with us about the recap.
Hello!
Pizzas?
Wow, three for three.
Yeah, I had to. I felt left out.
So Corey... had a lot of great interviews this past week. He had a lot of fun this past week. But what were your thoughts about that weather, dude? That covered it.
I don't have any words.
We actually went on a poke hunt.
Why do you make it sound like so creepy?
Is
that a thing? Is that what they call it?
It's a poke
hunt.
It's a poke hunt. We were walking around Seaport Village and we were capturing Pokemon, and it felt like
Don't you laugh, Chad?
No,
you don't have that right.
Ridiculous.
We are legitimate Pokemon trainers.
We were walking around. capturing Pokemon.
Exactly.
Just like you do.
Exactly. Like every other normal
person. I mean, like,
if
you were talking about the actual, like, life-size Pikachu that we saw and you actually captured it, then that would be one thing. But this is, like, you know, on your phone. Nobody else can see it. Yeah, it's
technically, well, technically, everybody else could see
not
it.
Not a person with their eyes without looking on their phone in
the
app. Well,
if they were looking on their phone, we would all be looking
at the same thing. I'm looking at a street corner. Well, this is a bad start to a joke. Never mind.
Yeah, it is.
But, you know, we were outside for a bit that morning on Wednesday, and it was just seriously so... The air was, like, so thick you could breathe it in, and it felt like just...
Hey, I don't want to hear it. I did a 5K.
Whatever.
On Sunday morning.
That he did. As far as activities-wise, there was a ton of stuff going on. We spoke the week before on San Diego Comic-Con prep, and one of the things that we did say, one of the stigmas about Comic-Con, is that there isn't enough to do outside, that everything's inside. And trust me, that is such a lie, because there was so many things to do outside of the con, from the Wonder Woman Invisible Jet Plane exhibit to the statue of Superman, false god statue that
was... Yeah, it was like a night and day experience. It was really cool.
It was. To the...
Batmobile was out there.
The Batmobile, the Square Enix experience. Corey, did you get to experience any of the stuff that was outside as well?
Nope. Not this year. I had thought I was the man. I thought I was the cock of the walk, as they say. I scheduled everything. I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to put like big hours in between my scheduled appointments. And then when I'm not doing those things, I will go outside and wait in lines and do all the fun stuff that you talked about. And it did not happen as such. I always left myself with just enough time to like not be able to like leave anywhere, but I'm also super early for my appointments.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not, unfortunately, get to just walk around the city streets as much as I would have wanted to.
Yeah. Well, I did. That's basically all I did. And there were quite a few things that were new, unique, and different this year that were fun. Even the Ecto-1 was there over in a different part from the original Ghostbusters. We took some photos with that, and you know, they had quite a few different exhibits and things to do. They always do, but you never know quite until you get there how quality they're going to be. I thought this year, overall, they were pretty good.
Yeah, there was a carnival there. Adult Swim was putting on a carnival. You had FX like overtaking an entire section of the front of the Hilton. You had, like I said, the Square Enix experience where there was a rock climbing wall. There was actually go-karts. There was a bungee game.
Yeah, it was like a tension shooter. We did this, some friends and I. It was a lot of fun. You were attached to a bungee cord, and you had to run out, get a laser gun, and shoot at a target without being pulled back by the tension on the cord. Pretty fun.
Yeah. And much like Corey, too, as well as with my schedule was jam-packed. I was able to experience some of these things on Saturday, luckily. But my schedule was just so much filled with a lot of appointments that I had to keep. But that didn't stop the con from releasing a lot of great stuff. I mean,
so much stuff.
So much.
To the public, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. Or no less. It wasn't even stuff that they're like, oh, nope, just for the con people. Nope, you can't have it. No.
It's Guardians of the Galaxy.
Unless it was Guardians. The one film, one Marvel film that people are like super interested in. And wanting to see footage and trailer, and that was the only one that didn't, you know, publicly release their stuff. But we did get a lot of great trailers from the Marvel's Doctor Strange to the Justice League trailer, the Wonder Woman trailer, the trailer for Kong Skull Island. You know, you had footage from, and also a trailer from Suicide Squad as well. Any of your guys' initial thoughts on any of those trailers? Any of those trailers stand out to you?
I think Doctor Strange is going to be pretty darn good.
Yeah?
Yeah. I was, I don't know. I don't think I was like Guardians of the Galaxy'd by it. Like that first Guardians trailer.
Guardians of the Galaxy'd.
And even the Bohemian Rhapsody Suicide Squad trailer got me really hyped. But still, that little joke at the end won me over with the Doctor Strange Wi-Fi password thing.
The savages.
Yeah. I loved it. And I'm sold on Cumberbatch.
Yeah.
And I was a little upset for a long time it wasn't going to be John Hamm, but...
yeah.
And you know, for all the jokes we do of John Hamm, that was seriously the one where I was like, he should be Doctor Strange.
I could see that.
That's one where he actually fit, but...
I had no doubt at all that it was going to be John Hamm, and then my dreams were crushed.
Yeah, Cumberbatch is okay.
He's all right. What about you, Chad? Any of these ones stand out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think... Well, number one, we've talked offline about Wonder Woman and how... Aside, all the trailer and storyline and everything aside, I love the electric guitar riff that they debuted. There you go.
Yeah,
they debuted in Batman versus Superman.
Yeah,
a little bit, and it's present again in the trailer. And when that riff hits, I just smile. Like I enjoy it. So it really doesn't matter what's happening on the screen, but it does look pretty amazing. What they're doing to establish her as, I mean, she is the first most iconic female superhero in the publishing world, and has a huge long 75 years I think she's celebrating this year as a character. So to finally have a movie, a multi-million dollar movie property to establish the character, you know, I think it's an exciting time.
For me, the one that really struck a note with me was the Justice League trailer, but I don't mean that in a good way. The Justice League trailer was such a letdown from what I was hoping was going to be a transition with the help of Suicide Squad to hopefully create a better environment or even a better world for these guys. Because you can see how much they're trying to lighten up the tone with Suicide Squad while still keeping, you know, certain serious parts and so forth. And then you see that similar type of world that they're trying to create, but they're trying to put the same darn Batman from Batman versus Superman and try to fit him into that, and it just doesn't work. And I'm looking at this trailer and I'm like, this trailer sucks. Like, I don't like it. It's
come on, Eddie, they listened to the people. We want lighthearted. We don't want all this brooding, gruesome, dark and dreary.
But Ben Affleck was still brooding, whatever. And it was like a rom-com.
What do you want from these people?
A whole new movie.
You're never happy, Aaron. Wow, I almost called you Aaron.
You almost called me Aaron.
Which is my co-host from the video
game. The page
game
has
bang.
Been turned.
Oh,
and
man.
That is not a compliment.
There's no coming back
that
from
is,
that.
That is, I...
you just proved it. You're the Aaron of the Filmosophers.
I just...
That's sad.
Here's the thing. Suicide Squad looks good for me. With this last trailer, I was actually pretty sold. I was still slightly on the fence, leaning more towards it, but still on the fence. And then with this last trailer, I was sold. I love the music. I love the tone of the film. I like the way they interact with each other. I love Will Smith in this movie. It is such a throwback to
that's because it's Will Smith.
Yeah, it's not like
Will Smith does serious acting.
Yeah, this isn't like Concussion all over again. This is like Will Smith, if Fresh Prince of Bel-Air was given a gun kind of deal. This is funny. This is fresh. This is cool.
Although I will say, because we were just talking about being Guardians of the Galaxy'd, right? Guardians of the Galaxy, they had that big musically driven trailer that everybody was like, oh, I'm going to take notice of this movie that I would not otherwise have paid attention to. And I think it's interesting that the Warner Brothers DC conglomerate is taking a page out of that very successful play and doing these kind of musical homages, backdrops, audio backdrops to the footage that they're showing, because people are connected to the songs already. So if you can connect these characters to the song, then if you like the song, you're going to want to see the movie. That it's not clever. It is clever.
For that Suicide Squad trailer, I was sold right away with that first song by 20 Pilots called Heathens. I mean, it fit so perfectly into that intro, and it sucked me in, and I was like, yeah, I want to see that. I really do. Along with the great trailers, we also got some awesome footage. Like Corey said, Guardians of the Galaxy released some footage, some stuff that honestly I didn't get a chance to see. I was going to say
they're not releasing that to the public anytime soon, but we have lots of recaps, written descriptions of what they showed.
You weren't in that panel?
No, absolutely not. Anything in Hall H that required waking up at 4 a.m. to wait in line to get a lottery ticket to maybe see something?
Nope.
Not worth my time.
I was going to say, we saw some people camped out overnight with sleeping bags.
We had a friend of ours who was, he was in another hotel room, but he had came to our hotel room at like 9:30, 10 o'clock on Wednesday night. and was like, all right, guys, I'm going to go take a nap. I'm going to get up at 2 or 3 so I can go and head over to the line. And I'm like, what line are you going to? I'm lining up for Hall H. I'm like, you're nuts. So, yeah.
He was also probably 400 people back.
Oh, more than likely.
I mean, they were literally camping on the lawn.
It's line con. That's what I like to call it, especially when you get inside. And usually, when you go to a convention or an event, you're waiting in line for like an experience or something free. In the case of San Diego Comic-Con, you're waiting in line generally to spend a lot of money. Like if you're trying to buy something, because there's those lines too. There's the Hall H line that's legendary. But then like if you want that exclusive Magic the Gathering promo set, you have to get up super early, wait in a line, get a little lottery ticket, and then possibly get a chance to go spend $100.
And that's if they haven't sold out within the first 30 minutes to an hour of the con opening. Because then you still had the people who were waiting in the Funko line. And that line was huge. They had lottery tickets that they were giving out, like kind of like what Corey said. You had lines for the Hasbro booth. You had lines for the Mattel booth. You had lines for the Sideshow Collectible booth. You had lines for the anime.
This is what I'm saying. You guys should join the rest of us on the outside.
Exactly.
Well, see,
there's no reason.
You also get a really nice tan.
Here's the thing. And this is one thing that we took advantage of, me and Corey, because we ended up walking more of the con floor than we did in any panel. We took full advantage of those press badges, and we were like press. We were like the police officers of all those crime scenes. Just walk on by and just like press. Here we go.
Wayne's World.
Yep.
That Wayne's World scene where they're walking with their badges at the Alice Cooper concert. Sorry.
We got casting news as well.
You guys did kind of look like Wayne and Garth too.
We tried. You know, we really did.
The flannel was a good look.
And that blonde hair wig that I had on, it worked for me. Party on, Wayne.
Party on, Garth.
Also, we got casting news from Marvel. I know this is something that Chad has been waiting on a long time right now. The reveal of who will be playing Captain Marvel. And we finally got our answer in Hall H at Comic-Con. Who is it, Chad?
Brie Larson from
Sacramento.
Most recently known from, well, from Sacramento.
She's
also
Sacramento alone.
Most recently seen in the very successful independent film Room.
The Room, Or Room.
Yeah, just Room. Not The Room.
Not The
just
Room.
Just Room.
You're tearing me apart, Lisa.
Oh, hi, Mark.
There we go. She's also going to be featured in Kong Skull Island, which also debuted a trailer, its first trailer at Comic-Con. So we'll have to see what she does in the fantastical action arena in that film before she even starts filming Captain Marvel, but at least there's a name to put there's a face to, anyway.
There's a name to go
There's a person for the character.
Yeah.
It's exciting.
Corey, what are your thoughts about the casting? I'm for me, like I told Chad, I wasn't all too sure about it, but let's get your opinion on it.
I don't know. I think it's probably a little bit more because she's like one of Hollywood's it girls right now.
Yeah.
Than necessarily her fitting the role. Like this definitely isn't Robert Downey Jr. playing Iron Man.
No.
They're definitely going to have to take the character and modify it more to her style.
Now here's the thing that I just happened to have watched. So she was nominated and won at the Oscars. Right. Mm-hmm. And something that I do not remember the outlet. I want to say it was IMDb, but I could be wrong about that. One of the outlets did a roundtable with all the Best Actress nominees. Mm-hmm. And they all sat around a table for an hour and talked. And I watched the whole thing. It was really interesting. And her perspective on being a young, barely known performer, now nominated for an Oscar, and the work that she's put into her career thus far and everything, I think that there is quite a bit under the surface with her that there hasn't been a reason to see it yet, and her filmography isn't robust enough for us to have seen it in play. And I'm hoping that, similar to the way that Robert Downey Jr. ran away with the role, or even I would say to a lesser extent, in Ant-Man, you had Paul Rudd, who was very well cast, and the movie was written for him, but kind of blossomed, Paul Rudd as a superhero. He's still a comedian, he's still jokey and whatever, but he was also believable in the heroic parts. So kind of, if they build it so that she can really inhabit it, well, I don't know that it's necessarily going to take changing her, but more drawing out more of kind of the behind the scenes thinking that she has, because she's, you know, got a very progressive mindset, and she's, you know, very thoughtful and has reasoned through a lot of the details of working in the biz, you know. And so one of the big hallmarks of Captain Marvel as a character, Carol Danvers, is she also has, you know, had to survive and thrive in a previously male-dominated environment. She was part of the Air Force and NASA, I believe, in her early days as a comic book character. So it'll be interesting to see how much of that they even put in the movie.
Yeah, I think she's a great actress. I mean, I don't, no doubting that, especially after Room. And then, like, I remember she was on United States of Terra. You know, she was good in that. She even had some small roles on Community as Abed's love interest. I like her, and I think they're going to have to adjust the character of Ms. Marvel to fit today's 2016 moviegoer, because when you look at Ms. Marvel, Carol Danvers, you know, despite the character parts, like the costume, she's very busty, you know, the costume is like basically a swimming suit. You know, she
has been, yeah. The more recent one is not,
it, now she was, you know, they switched the whole character up. You know, wasn't she like Middle Eastern or something like that?
No, that's a different character entirely. So that's the new Ms. Marvel, because Carol Danvers became Captain Marvel because she took on the mantle of an alien hero named Captain Marvel who died. Anyway, so
the costume's gonna have to change.
So
they're not gonna put, you know, this progressive actress in a,
definitely not use the swimsuit version of the costume.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
So I don't know.
It wouldn't be very functional for all the stunt work and everything. I mean, it just wouldn't make a lot of sense.
Just off the jump, I have a feeling that if I had to put money on which one will be the better movie and the most critically acclaimed, I have a feeling that just for some reason Wonder Woman strikes me is that it'll be the winner
as far as the first female superhero film
getting the spotlight in, you know, the next couple years. I just have a feeling that they just really did a good job with this Wonder Woman. The trailer was great. Gal Gadot fits perfect with that character,
and quite frankly the character deserves a win.
Yeah,
I mean, like, it's they haven't made a movie. They've tried for well over a decade, probably closer to two decades, to make a big budget Wonder Woman movie, and they always abandon it because there are a lot of easy pitfalls that could totally screw it up for the mainstream audience. And then there are other things that, like, the long-term fans would be really upset if you kept it out.
Yeah.
So hopefully they found that balance. Yeah. I mean, it's Amazon's, for crying out loud. What's not to love about that?
True. Right. They always bring my stuff on time in 2 hours, so... Also, what else we did over at San Diego Comic-Con, the film Lost Words got a chance to conduct an interview. We got a chance to sit down and discuss the infamous trilogy called Red Rising and its upcoming prequel comic with the author himself, Pierce Brown. Chad and I, we had about a good 20-30 minute conversation with him, and he's a great guy. Awesome.
Very fun conversation.
He's
young dude. This is like his big, like, you know, ascendant kind of work, and it's a well-built story universe. I found it in the very beginning with the first book, with Red Rising, introduced you to it. Now there are three books, all of which are more exciting than the one before it. There's a ton of story and backstory that you get through, but it's not boring.
Yeah.
It's very, I think the term that he used was velocity.
Yeah.
Kind of was the dictator of the pace.
Yeah. It keeps driving forward and it keeps moving forward. There aren't any dead spots in the book and so forth. And like I said, the trilogy itself, it's a great series. If you have a chance, look it up. It is the Red Rising trilogy. Written by Pierce Brown, and we will be posting that interview in all its audio in a separate show for your enjoyment. So stay tuned later on for the rest of the week as we put that out there on our Facebook page, Twitter page, and so forth. And
lots of cool things are happening for him. He seems like a great guy from what we've been able to discuss, and happy for him. He's got a prequel comic series, like you said, through Dynamite. which is one of the smaller publishing houses, but, you know, still has been around for decades and does really great work. And the series has been optioned for film. They have a director attached. Pierce himself is helping to write the initial script before it's all configured for, you know, with stage directions and whatnot.
Yep.
So we're expecting big things from that property.
Yep. And so, as I said, stay tuned later on for the rest of the week when we post that interview. But overall thoughts, guys. Corey, what was your thought about Comic-Con this year?
It was just a lot. A lot of everything. A lot of walking, a lot of fun, a lot of good times, a lot of bad times, a lot of alcohol, a lot of soberness, a lot of heat, a lot of coldness, just a lot of everything. It was just a lot.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, I'm glad to be home, but I can't wait to go back.
What about you, Chad?
My key word for this experience would be active. Part of that is because of the group of friends that I went around with, but just the Square Enix stuff was a very activity-based experience. Obviously, the walking around part, the 5K that I participated in, not connected to Comic-Con, but on Sunday morning, went to the beach, you know, just like all kinds of things. You can really build your own experience, and you should when you go.
Yeah.
Because everyone listening should try to go at least once. It's quite the experience.
Yeah. I think one thing I can take away from this year, I think the two words that sum up my whole time this past week was can be summed up in learning experience. Because I packed my schedule quite a bit, and as much as it wasn't an overwhelming kind of thing, like Corey said, I didn't get a lot of opportunities to go check out a lot of things that I would have liked to have checked out. But on the other hand, I was face-to-face with a lot of celebrities, a lot of actors, actresses, directors, voice actors, and that was a good payoff for me, but I still would have liked to have seen, you know, like the footage from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 or see the announcement of Brie Larson and things like that. So it's one of those things of that whole balancing act with the schedule, and next year I'm going to be a little bit more mindful, but I think the thing for me to take away from all that is learning experience. So, but that brings us into our review for today. And ladies and gentlemen, we got a doozy for you. Yes, we are reviewing Jason Bourne.
So excited that this movie has come out.
Not only are we reviewing it, we are literally coming here straight from, I know we've joked about it before, but we are right now, as we speak, coming straight from the theater.
Yeah, we literally left the theater and came straight to the recording studio.
We are. So this is all fresh. This is all still in our heads, and for the most part. So, you know, we're going to have a good time talking about this real quick and just have an awesome time. But, Jason Bourne, this is the fifth installment.
It's the fifth in the series, the fourth with Matt Damon,
because the fourth one did have, I forget his name.
Jeremy Renner,
mm-hmm. Which was Bourne Supremacy.
No, that was the Bourne Legacy.
Because they have Bourne Identity.
The Bourne Identity, the Bourne Supremacy, and then the Bourne Ultimatum.
That's right.
Then there was a lull for about 5 years, and then you had the Bourne Legacy, which was sort of the spin-off attempt that people didn't receive all that well, and so now we're back to Jason Bourne.
I think, just a quick side note, I think one of the best things that there's a lot of things, but one of the best things I like about this film is that song, that theme song to this film. It's so retro for me, so 70s, I love it. But Jason Bourne, directed by Paul Greengrass, stars Matt Damon, Tommy Lee Jones, Alicia Vikander, Vincent Cassel, and Julia Stiles. Quick flash synopsis, we got Jason Bourne, now remembering who he truly is, tries to uncover the hidden truths about his past. This film is such an action-packed sequence of events that occur throughout the entire film. It's a two-hour film. Technically, it's 123 minutes, so a little over 2 hours, not by much. But every single second of it...
Some of that's probably the credits rolling, so...
That's true. The film, though, is one fluid piece of work as it moves through from, you know, the first second all the way to that last second. It is filled with content that is just moving at all times. And
yeah, not a lot of downtime in the movie.
There really
wasn't.
But
it's not like that annoying percussive kind of activity. Some of the scenes are quieter scenes. It's just, it's all still building. You just have this like inevitable building toward the climax of the film.
Now, these films are based off of a book series that Chad has stated previous. So there is source material that, you know, the directing team and the creative team are pulling from. So as we get into this film, we are at a point where Jason Bourne is ultimately by himself. He has, as in his own words, gone off the grid and is making money, you know, doing, you know, little fights here and there, making quick cash. All the while, we have people who are returning from the previous films, such as Julia Stiles. Julia Stiles was in the second one and first one, I believe.
Yeah, I think she appears in all of the first Does three she? In some form or fashion. But she was a big player in the first one, mm-hmm. a sort of big player in the second one, and then not as much in the third,
yeah.
if I remember correctly. It's been a while since I've watched all of them, I'll be honest.
It's her appearance in the film and what she does that kind of slingshots Jason Bourne back into the limelight of the CSI's attention.
Yeah, it's interesting because the film, and this is something I was totally loving and geeking out about, when the opening credits are starting, it's a black screen with white text over it, and the music that you hear is the same opening track from The Bourne Identity where he's floating on the water.
Mm-hmm.
I was literally seeing that scene in my mind.
Which, mind you, the only reason why you knew this is because you actually have that particular soundtrack.
I loved that soundtrack when it first came out.
I gotta
go dig it out and listen to it again.
It's not exactly something that you'll recognize offhand, but if you are a fan of the series, that is a great little nugget for all the diehards that love the film.
Yeah, it's fun. And for all you young ones at home, yes, I do have it on CD.
Mm-hmm.
I know. It dates me, but
at least you didn't say cassette.
Well, yeah. So, but the other thing that happens right before you see anything is you hear a voiceover from Matt Damon as Jason Bourne saying, "I remember everything," and that is your lead in to the film. Which, ironically, I have a question: having seen the film, is that voiceover supposed to have happened before the story or now after the story? Because over the course of the film, it's made very clear that he doesn't remember everything, because part of his journey, as it always has been, is learning about his own past,
mm-hmm.
and what made him who he is now.
That's a good question.
So, but yeah, you do have that lead in, like, "I remember everything," and then you start with the, you know, the brawling on the side and some flashbacks of pseudo memories that get fleshed out a little bit later on. But yeah, it's one of those. I thought it was very ironic that he thinks he remembers everything, and he doesn't actually. There's a lot that he doesn't know that he learns over the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Now, Matt Damon has made a name for himself throughout all these films, from the very first Bourne Identity through, as you said, the Bourne Supremacy, Bourne Ultimatum, and now we have Jason Bourne. One thing that we've noticed with Matt Damon is that he can be a very versatile actor. We've seen him do comedy with like the Ocean's 11 mm-hmm. Series. We've seen him do serious films with like The Talented Mr. Ripley. What is that one?
Good Will Hunting,
of course. Mm-hmm. We've seen him do a number of things. We've seen him do like The Absurd. He played a rocker in the band that was playing in Eurotrip. Kind of older film, but he was the rocker, and you know, Scotty doesn't know that song, he's the one who's singing it, and so we know that his spectrum is pretty wide and it's pretty broad, but as far as him in this particular role, I have to say it still surprises me when I see how much he's investing his own self altogether for this role, because I can see Ben Affleck working out and doing all that kind of stuff, and you know, with Batman versus Superman, you know, he obviously had to do all that. But for this role, Jason Bourne is a thick and just power. He's a powerful looking individual.
Absolutely,
he's not super built. He's not super cut. He's not all these things. But his, you know, just the thickness of his arms and the way he holds himself. He's
pretty built. He's pretty cut in this movie.
But the
interesting thing. We've talked a couple of times before. We recently went to Australia on a mm-hmm. trip. And one of the things that I found really cool is I would wake up at, you know, like 4 a.m. local time every day because of the time difference and turn on their morning show, Sunrise. And the first morning that I turned it on, they actually had Matt Damon there and Alicia Vikander. They were promoting this movie because it had just had its Sydney premiere the night before. And one of the things that Matt Damon said during the interview was, way back in the beginning for The Bourne Identity, one of the things that the director wanted him to do was to learn how to walk like a boxer, because this character throws down with people all the time. He's a trained assassin, and so he has to both take people out and protect himself. So he's been trained very similarly to how a boxer is trained to take a beating and not, like, go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so way back then, he was saying, you know, however many years ago, 15 years ago, 14 years ago, however long that was, he was saying, you know, way back then they had him, like, observing the way that boxers move when they're not in the ring. Like, how do they walk down a street? How do they go through a supermarket? And so he started mimicking that. In this film, that kind of posturing, if you will, comes full circle because he is a brawler in the outset of the film, and he looks the part.
He does. Matt Damon just kind of... This particular role for him, I feel, suits him really well, because when it comes to Matt Damon, I'm not really big on his vocal presence. His vocal presence doesn't really do much for me. He can, you know, how do you like them apples, all that kind of stuff. He has his little quips here and there, you know, things that he said in Saving Private Ryan and all that. But he's more of a physical presence on set. I see him and you know, when he's doing his scenes where he's disappearing around this corner, or he's eluding these people here, or he's, you know, walking off and he knows the right time to do this and this and that. I see him more as a physical actor, but I don't think his vocal presence on a set or even on screen is as strong as that. What do you think?
I think it would depend on the property. In this particular film and in this series, I think that it's a deliberate choice to keep his voice evenly modulated, keep his face calm in almost every circumstance. Every once in a while, you see a flicker of strong emotion, but I think part of the subtext of his character is that, I mean, he's a trained stone cold killer, hopefully doing it for the right reasons. I mean, he sometimes doesn't even know anymore, because his programming, or whatever you call it, has been glitchy ever since we've met him, you know, floating on the ocean with that reflective vest. And so there's a certain aspect to the character that is reserved. It's that whole compelling, power held in tension. Like, he's the coiled spring that you just really don't ever want to see, like, explode, really. Yeah. Because while he's calm and collected and focused, he's devastating all on his own in that regard. So to ever see him break out with a strong show of emotion, rage, anger, even joy potentially, it might be really a lot to take in, because his whole, like, power held in check mode, which is where he operates pretty much all the time, even when he's zipping backwards through traffic or up and down staircases in a car or brawling with people or, you know, fighting with a pen or whatever throughout the whole series, like, his intensity is incredible, but he's not showing it, you know, in his face or in his voice, because the character is still under control. He's doing it under his own power, not out of emotion.
One other character that we thought was pretty intriguing, and of course, it's not so much more as the character, but more of the allure of the actor, is Tommy Lee Jones' performance in the film. You can't not like Tommy Lee Jones. It's almost...
I sure can't.
Every time I see him on screen, I love his character. I love what he does, and I love the way he always portrays each character, whether if it's No Country for Old Men, where he plays the sheriff on the lookout for Javier Bardem, or you have him in Men in Black right next to someone like Will Smith, playing a defender of the universe. I feel like Tommy Lee Jones is just one of those actors that continues to just still be great, even despite how far along he is in his life.
Definitely. Well, and the thing is, like, he's got a thing that he does, right? Like, he's one of those rare actors that, not that he's not acting. He is acting. He's doing a role every time. And he adds nuance into his performances and whatnot. He's professional, and we respect him for that. But he's also always still Tommy Lee Jones. You know, like, sometimes I have this issue with Leonardo DiCaprio. I can almost never see the character that he's playing, no matter how hard he's trying and working at it, because all I see is Leonardo DiCaprio. Part of that is because he almost never ages. You know, it takes him like 8 years to look like he's aged 1 year.
He still looks like he's something from there. What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Yeah, I mean, there's something there that's just that cognitive dissonance, that weird, like the uncanny valley kind of experience for me. But on the flip side, you've got Tommy Lee Jones, who always brings a smile to my face as soon as I see him. I don't care if it's a serious role, a comedic role. If he's a good guy, a bad guy, doesn't matter. He makes me smile.
Yeah. And in this one, unfortunately, he does play the bad CIA director who is on the hunt for Jason Bourne, not so much as for reasons that Jason Bourne may have started or may not have started, but for the simple fact that he wants to eliminate Jason Bourne because of what Jason Bourne had done in the previous films, which was shed a light on the covert ops that they had going on.
Yeah, it caused a whole mess of trouble.
Yeah.
For the CIA.
So Tommy Lee Jones, as I said, is the CIA director who is leading this manhunt against Jason Bourne with the help of Alicia Vikander, who plays the head of the team that is, you know, being led by Tommy Lee Jones. She's the one who's running point on the CIA team, who's trying to get him. And as the film continues, Alicia Vikander is realizing that it's not so much of something that he's done, which is Jason Bourne, but it's more of a personal vendetta that the director, Tommy Lee Jones, and the director's asset, which is the guy who's trying to kill Jason Bourne, their own personal agendas with
Definitely.
Tommy Lee.
Well, the interesting thing about this story is there's a lot that's familiar. If you've seen the other Bourne movies, you know that at some point in the film, Jason Bourne is going to have to go head-to-head with another highly trained, highly skilled assassin who's even colder than he is, you know, than Jason Bourne. And so that's, you know, Vincent Cassell plays that role. He's the asset. I don't believe you ever learn his name in the film. He's always referred to as the asset. He does have some backstory that you learn over the course of the film. But then, and you have, you know, Tommy Lee Jones is now our government representative, who's the bad guy puppet master pulling the strings. That's always been the case. You had Christopher Columbus, you had Albert Finney, you had Brian Cox, you know, all these guys
all in the previous films.
Formerly, you know, the guy running the program who's devious and shouldn't be in charge, can't be trusted. So here you've got Tommy Lee Jones, you know, occupying a similar role. The thing that I thought was really interesting about this story is you take essentially the role that Julia Stiles played in the first film, which was that conscientious, like not quite objector, but getting to the point of being an objector, the younger person on the team, the new blood, if you will.
Yeah.
She doesn't really play that role so much in this film as much as Alicia Vikander does. The character that Alicia Vikander plays is very self-aware of the fact that she is the new blood in the CIA.
Yeah.
And she makes deliberate, like, political decisions within that hierarchy, for good or for bad, to influence the situation and to do things perhaps a little differently. I think the thing that interested me was that her character from the outset has more influence within the CIA infrastructure than Julia Stiles' character ever did.
Yeah. And one thing that you have to... Well, real quick side note, because I was just thinking about this when you were mentioning that. One quick thing. One of our members of the VGB crew is... his name happens to be David Webb. And the name, which I hadn't really realized up until when we saw this film, I didn't know that Jason Bourne's real name was David Webb.
Yeah, his birth name.
His birth name in the film is David Webb. So, in case you know the real David Webb, watch out, because he could actually be Jason Bourne. And
that's a very interesting diversion. I'm not sure how to follow it up, but I'm pretty sure he's not Jason Bourne.
You never know. Hey, he lives on the other side of town. So, but aside from that, one of the great things that was interesting about the storyline about this film was that it is taking a page out of current history events, current and recent
Absolutely,
events.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because the film is encompassing the situation of internet privacy. It is all about the government trying to make a deal with this world-renowned firmware operating system creator known as Deep Dreams. And they apparently have this...
data collecting.
Yeah.
It's a whole universe of apps that you would have on your smartphone or your smartwatch or whatever, and It's collecting all the data so that you get a highly customized, tailored experience of your life.
Yeah.
And you get what you want. And that's what a lot of the providers in our real world are offering. Well, in this movie, this Deep Dreams entity was actually started with government funding and is in bed with members of the CIA to share information without telling the public.
Yeah, and I thought that was a really risky but, you know, paid off move. Because I love the idea. I love the fact that they are putting it out there that, you know, one of the key words that Tommy Lee Jones says when he's meeting with the head of this company, whom they're the ones who are doing the exchange of agreements and whatnot, is telling them, you know, that privacy is freedom. And when you risk the privacy of other people, you're risking the freedom. And you know, he's like, I can't create. And it was funny because he said this exact word. He said, I need you to create a backdoor for me in your operating system. The government official is asking this. And I'm like,
right. He totally sidesteps the moral compass argument.
He's like, in case for national security. And it's funny that he says that when we were just having this issue not too long ago with Apple and the situation that occurred in San Bernardino.
Unlocking the phone or not, and can the government say, oh, well, national security, and then you just unlock every door and open it, or should there be more accountability behind that whole process? It's, like you said, it's a very current debate. It's a very current story arc to have in there. It's not the dominant arc because that still belongs to Jason Bourne. I mean, it always has. It always should, I think, in this series. We'll see what happens because they're talking about spinning off a side character with The Rock. He's already been cast and hired. So we'll see. There are other characters that the man who wrote the Bourne Identity, the original book, wrote other characters in a similar vein. So they are trying to enlarge the universe and make it last longer than perhaps what Matt Damon may be willing or able to do.
Yeah.
But I think this is an important return to form because...
Yeah, oh, most definitely.
That fourth film was called The Bourne Legacy, and they tried to bank on the word legacy for that. But these films have always been banking on the Bourne. Like, the Bourne part of it is the important part of it.
Yeah.
So you can't cut that out and have something that truly works.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie has a lot of Jason Bourne. And you're, once again, watching him have this existential crisis of sorts. He doesn't want to get involved. And then he can't help but be involved. And that's because it all revolves around him, even though... he didn't choose for it to be that way.
Even to the point where he's questioning the fact of choosing not to kill. And there's even a semi-funny but still serious scene between him and Tommy Lee Jones where Matt Damon tells him, you know, I'm trying to find another way. And with this, you know, pistol pointed right at Tommy Lee Jones's chest, and Tommy Lee Jones looks at the gun and looks at him and says, so how's that working for you? And it's still funny, but then it still has that sense of groundedness in, like you said, the existential conversation that Matt Damon is having with himself as far as realizing is there really anything else more to him other than killing? And I believe that kind of escalates the mindset and the evolution of his thinking from when we first met him in Bourne Identity, of him still trying to figure out who he is, to realizing the bits and pieces of himself, to having some sort of self-realization that he was a weapon, he was a soldier of sorts, to realizing if he can turn that off. And that's also one of the big buttons that they push on this film, in this film, is whether or not if he's anything else more than just a soldier who has these deep-rooted patriotic feels, or if he can have the opportunity to actually turn it off, to actually be more than just that. And this really digs into a lot of those questions with
It has a couple character. Of moments within the story, thanks to one of the characters, where you kind of get into just some brief little takeaways into his psychology, because he has gone through the Treadstone program. And so the psych evaluator for that program once upon a time wrote some comments about whether or not his identity as an operative is changeable. Like, is it immutable?
Yeah.
Or is it changeable? Is it something that's completely inevitable that he's just always going to be that way because the training slash programming slash brainwashing, whatever it is that they did to them, which we still don't entirely know.
Yeah.
Does that go so deep that there is no other option that will work psychologically, that will work for somebody like Jason Bourne?
Yeah. Moving on to a little bit more on the logistical side of the film, one of the great things about this film, and I think this is something that you can really pinpoint in a lot of great sequences nowadays, whether if it's on Netflix or if it's on a TV show or even if it's in a film. One of the great things that you can always recognize, amongst other things, are great choreographed fight scenes. You have sequences where sometimes the choreography is a little too far-fetched and you're like, oh, well, that's kind of, you know, that's not for the style of film this is, or the style of show this is, and this style of fighting, you know, nobody's going to be standing on a tree branch trying to fight somebody with something else like that. That's just too out there. But this film really, like we mentioned earlier, really lends to the mindset of the brawler mentality. And every fight sequence that Jason Bourne has, which he's always had with pretty much since Bourne Identity.
Absolutely.
That's always been
that set the tone.
Yeah.
Right from the get-go.
It is those really just gritty and realistic just thug fest, you know, that they have just throwing fists at each other and
I mean, I still remember that apartment in France.
Yes,
with the pen and the mm-hmm. yeah, all of that. It was a unique
yes,
fight choreography style at the time. Mm-hmm. It had not been done that way before, really. Yeah.
And these sequences, it's not hyped with music. It's not amped up with things like that. The fight sequence is what overtakes the scene. It is not the sound around it. It is not the music that enthralls the entire sequence. You know,
you're hearing like the thwack of,
yeah,
you know,
you're hearing
a fist on a face.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
You know, the swipe of knives, and you're hearing the
whatever weaponry they're finding around them to use against each other.
And I think that sets the film so much apart from a lot of other films who try to do this. Like you had the Jack Ryan film with Chris Pine that came out a couple years back, and the film kind of was a little bit out there. It didn't really do it all for me as far as the Jack Ryan film. And then you have films like the Jack Reacher film with Tom Cruise, which is okay, but still, you know, there's a lot of too much stylization that goes into it. That doesn't make it as believable as other films. And then you got stuff like this with Jason Bourne. The sequences that they did, that they filmed, that they planned out were so expertly done. And you can tell these guys did their homework, you know, with Matt Damon and Vincent Cassell being two of the main contenders that usually end up fighting each other. The sequences are just incredible. I love them.
Absolutely. Well, and there's a lot of like throwback. It's interesting because for people who pay attention to fight choreography in film, mm-hmm. there can be a sort of a dialogue. There are like little homage moments sometimes, like a certain move that was done in a different film that you see done here, because the choreographers, obviously this is their job. Like this yeah. is their livelihood. It's a passion of theirs, and they do it well. And so I think that there's a lot within this film that references some of the other films in the series,
yeah.
in the sequence. The other thing that was really noticeable and has always been a hallmark of a Bourne film is the car chase work.
Yes.
This film, more ambitious than the other ones, totally shut down the Las Vegas Strip
yeah.
for several evenings and filmed a huge car chase sequence. Huge, enormous.
Yeah.
Like to think that they did not do this in CGI. They did not do this on a soundstage with miniatures. They did this with actual vehicles on the Las Vegas Strip.
Yeah.
Mind-blowing to watch.
Our fly on the wall producer, Mr. Corey Vincent, actually was in Las Vegas at the time, and he was telling us how their Uber was pulling up to one of the streets, and he's like, oh, yeah, you know, Jason Bourne, it's being filmed over there. And I've never been to Las Vegas. But I can only imagine how, I know you've been a couple times mm-hmm. and Corey's been, I can only imagine how busy and how alive it is at night. And to be able to shut down a good portion of the strip, that alone has to be some feat in itself. And then to be able to leave the kind of carnage that vehicle did yeah. in the middle of Las Vegas.
Yeah, not just shutting down the street, but staging all of the vehicles in all the different places, having the carnage, and then having the cleanup.
Oh, yeah.
All before people need to get to work the next morning. I mean, those people deserve an Oscar.
Oh, yeah. Like, without a doubt.
Behind the scenes work. I don't know what you'd call that, but they need one.
Another thing, too, that's always unique when it comes to the Bourne films is the music. The music in itself, kind of like what we talked about earlier with the opening theme song. That opening theme song that we, you know, started out with is prevalent not only in the first Bourne film, but the second one, the third one. I'm not too sure about the Bourne Legacy. I didn't watch that one. And it's in this one. That theme song just gives you so many different feelings when you're listening to it because it's such a throwback to classic 70s spy films, classic 70s American spy films. You know, things that you remember and things that you know, when you watch those grainy films and you watch the TV shows that were on, you know, at the time, the cop shows and things like that. That's what I envision every time I hear it. And when I hear this theme song, it seems to just fit so well as like the traveling mercenary who's trying to live his own life and try to do his own thing and try to live off the grid. And it just it fits for me.
It's interesting because I have always had a very different response to the theme song and the music in general. Mm-hmm. To me, it feels very European. Mm. And part of that is because the film series actually does a lot of work in Europe. Even this one is Greece, Italy, England, like there are several, Germany, there are several European area settings that they visit for a period of time or whatever. So it's always struck me. I mean, yeah, it has kind of that little bit of a funky, like older mm-hmm. style, but it feels very discotheque, you know, discotheque, like very, it feels very European to me. And I think that's a big part of the DNA of the series, exactly. Actually, because when you think about, you know, in America, especially right now, there's a lot of conversation and rhetoric happening around the idea of patriotism. What does that mean? And in Europe, if you were to have a similar conversation in some areas of Europe, it would have a very different shade. It would stereotypically, I realize I'm saying this, it would have more maybe a contemplative, maybe more of a willingness to not trust what you're being told or sold by the media, by the government, by whatever, because in Europe, history goes a lot deeper and older than here.
Yeah.
And there have been ebbs and flows for generations upon generations, right? And so you've got this sort of, again, that existential crisis kind of thing happened in Europe, especially after the First World War and then after the Second World War, much more intensely than it did in America. So now you've got an American power structure, an American story, but you have kind of that, I don't know, that contemplativeness. It's hard for me to describe. It's that it, you see it a lot more in European film.
Yeah.
I guess is what I'm trying to say.
All in all, it was a great film. The film does end with a great twist that, you know, we're not going to ruin for you because, honestly, it's one of those special things where when you go
and to
see
your
the film,
point, the music shifted. There's a scene in the hotel suite where some of the characters make some very definitive choices, and there was a new musical cue that happened.
Yes.
And I was like, ooh, that's clever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry. Keep talking.
No, but all in all, the film ends greatly. It has a really good twist to the end of it. You think the film's going to go one way, and it shifts a little bit of the gears a bit, and you're like, oh, that was pretty cool. And it does give you a satisfying ending in hopes that you're going to find more coming out, you know, in future films. You're going to see more of the Jason Bourne franchise. But all in all, Chad, how many monocles and does it pass or fail?
Well, it definitely passes. That's the easy answer. The monocles question. I think I'd give it a 4.
Really?
Some of that is nostalgia points, I'll be honest. There are a few missteps. I think sticking so closely to the pattern of the other movies is a little bit of a hindrance in the sense of like, why did Tommy Lee Jones have to be one of the bad guys just because he was the head of the CIA? I mean, I know it's kind of written into the DNA of the story. I get that. But it's so familiar that it's hard to see them do it with yet another leader of the CIA. you know, old guy in charge of the CIA.
Yeah.
Once again, the puppet master bad guy. Like, couldn't they have done something different? I don't know. So it loses a few points there. Also, they kind of overstress some of the connections between the characters, specifically Matt Damon and Vincent Cassell, their characters.
Yeah.
They have, like, one level of connection that you learn about halfway through the movie that would be totally more than enough to justify what they do. But then there's a whole other level of connection that's introduced later in the story that I didn't see the need for it.
Yeah.
I get the utility, the script utility of having it be that way. I don't know that it added anything. It kind of seemed a little contrived to me. So yeah, 4 monocles out of 5 for me, but still very enjoyable experience.
For me, it's definitely a pass. The film is a great homage to those types of films. Not only in the Bourne series, not only is it a great installment in the Bourne series, but it's also a great homage to those classic spy films and those classic espionage films that we remember growing up. As far as monocles, I do give it a 3.5. More on the lines of the same reasons why Chad gave it. I thought the connection between the main antagonist, which was Tommy Lee Jones, and his drive to want to pin all these things on Jason Bourne and try to want to, you know, really break him down. I thought that was a little repetitive, as well as the connection between the hitman or the asset and Jason Bourne as well. That kind of was stretching a little bit too far to make those two have that connection so that the ending could be all the much more sweeter, or the last battle or so forth. But all in all, the film does deliver on all the action sequences. It does deliver on the continuation and the fluidity of the film. It doesn't bore at all. It continues to move, and it'll definitely satisfy you if you're looking for a good espionage film.
The other thing I wanted to point out, and this is more on the technical side of things, is the camera work. It's very close up, like these have always been in terms of showing fights, but there's so much depth to the shot most of the time. There's so much detail and thought that is put into things like walking through multiple crowds of protesters in Athens, Greece, mm-hmm. near the beginning of the film, which we saw in the trailers before the film came out. There's so much detail that was put into it. You know, you got to give Paul Greengrass and his crew credit.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. So that about wraps up our review for Jason Bourne. Let us know what you think on our Facebook page and our Twitter page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a few movie bites. At the top of that list, Project Greenlight. Speaking of Matt Damon, Project Greenlight was not renewed by HBO. The series is now looking for a new home. Project Greenlight being the show that Matt Damon and Ben Affleck both started many years ago. The show that gives young filmmakers and creative minds the opportunity to present a film, an independent film, or their ideas to these guys and their backers and essentially pick one to green light.
It's like Shark Tank for movies.
Exactly.
Kind of, in a way.
So it was only a matter of time before, you know.
Well, and they had some
snafu
controversy over this past season. So it's understandably, from a political standpoint, it's understandable why HBO might not want to continue the deal.
I don't know. HBO has been pretty risque lately. I mean,
well, yeah, but in a different way.
Also on our list, Charlie Hunnam will not be returning to Pacific Rim 2 Maelstrom.
This one's really surprising because he was like the main character.
Yeah, he was the main character.
He and the Japanese woman, mm-hmm. they were like the two main characters. So
yeah, removing him from the, you know, focus of the film, it makes you wonder. Obviously, we know John Boyega is going to be on the film, is part of the cast that was announced a while back. So it should be interesting to see John Boyega's character interacting with a whole slew of other people that we're still not sure yet who the rest of the cast is. But knowing that this, you know, pretty dominant character from the previous film won't be returning, it is a bit of a surprise. So we'll see how that ends up and how it falls on the floor, how we, you know, it progresses. Lastly on our list, Joss Whedon expresses interest in a Black Widow solo film. So obviously we would have figured after the incidents with Age of Ultron and so forth, Joss Whedon from that point on decided to take a step back and say, you know what, I'm kind of done with Marvel film. I'm going to kind of give it a rest for a bit and do other things. Well, now apparently according to IGN, Joss Whedon kind of expressed a little bit of interest to them at Comic-Con, stating that he would be interested in doing a Black Widow solo film.
Not really surprising. I mean, yeah. Ever since he participated, he drove the process of the Avengers film from a script and directing standpoint. I mean, way early on, he like got teary-eyed talking about Black Widow's past and all this stuff. I mean, he has a certain level of connection with that character, I think, that it's not surprising he'd be interested. A solo film for her would be a very different animal than, you know, a team film, which he very visibly, very demonstrably got burned out, you know, the last time he did that with Age of Ultron. But yeah, I think the Black Widow franchise, if they started one, and there's a big push for it behind the scenes and in front of the scenes, really, I think that he could do it because it's not the same type of movie. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it seems to have a very personal resonance for him.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that goes and what Joss Whedon ends up doing. But that about wraps up our show for today. So let us know what you think about Jason Bourne. Do you agree with us on our review? Do you agree that it deserves the amount of monocles we gave it? Do you think it passes or fails? Let us know in the comments on the Facebook page and our Twitter page. And, of course, let us know if there's anything you'd like us to review later on in the future. If there's films you think that would be awesome to put on the show, past or present, let us know and drop us a line. Again, you can check us out on VGBstudios.com as well as our Facebook page and Twitter. And you can find all our episodes, current and previous. And give us a listen. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.